Welcome to the Jalada Conversations. These are conversations about literature and writing, and we talk to some of the continent's most exciting and respected writers. Today, I shall be talking over Skype about writing and language with Nigerian author Chika Onigwe. Chika is from Enugu, Nigeria, and has lived in Belgium and the USA. She's a prolific author of fiction, poetry, articles, and educational material. She has won numerous awards, including the 2003 BBC Short Story Competition, the Commonwealth Short Story Award, the Flemish Literary Prize for her first short story written in Dutch, as well as the prestigious Nigerian Prize for Literature for her novel, On Black Sister Street. On Black Sister Street is a wonderful, poignant story about four women who have left the African continent for Belgium in search of better lives and their experiences. The main character, Chisom Osisi, around whom the story revolves, is a particularly feisty and memorable character. Chika's stories have been broadcast on the BBC World Service, Radio Nigeria, and other Commonwealth radio stations. One of the most interesting facts about her is that she writes in Dutch as well as English. Chika, it's such an honor to be speaking with you today. Thank you for taking the time to talk about writing and language.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote an essay titled Losing My Voice that was published in the Aeon magazine. And it's this tender story about moving from Nigeria to Belgium and acclimatizing to a new culture, a new language. And in it, you know, you write, nothing I knew before seemed to be of consequence, not language, not social etiquette. You write that during your first days of learning Dutch, it sounded deceptively like English, but made no sense at all. But you went on to learn Dutch and you've written stories in Dutch. Your novels have been published in Dutch and in English, and you've been called in Belgium a Flemish author of African origin. So that space has embraced you the same way home has. I'm interested in your experience of assimilating the Dutch language. How did this come about, and how did this translate into the act of writing in Dutch?
I moved to Belgium as a grown up. So I had a university degree before I moved to Belgium. I wasn't 18. I wasn't a teenager. And I think that one of the things that was very important for me to do, having moved to Belgium, apart from getting close to, you know, my husband's family and whatever was important to my Belgian husband, was also learning the language so that, I could feel more, maybe not at home, but so I could feel more like I belonged, because not being able to speak a language locks you out of a lot of things. I remember, I always felt a bit left out when his family visited, and the fact that I couldn't be a part of that communication, a part of that conversation happening at the table, no matter how traveled those conversations were, I found very frustrating. So that was one. Secondly, when I moved to Belgium, I also knew I was going to live in Belgium for a while. And part of me living there for a while also included being able to work there. And Belgium is the sort of country where, I mean, English isn't the official language. And you can hardly get any job if you don't speak Dutch as well as English, as well as, you know, other languages. But the starting point, is at least in Flanders, is Dutch. And so I wanted to be a part of that community as well. So it was out of necessity. Also out of, and I love words. I love language. I love, I remember my father telling me once that when I was young, I used to say I wanted to be an ambassador. And so it seemed like a perfect opportunity moving to a country where a different language was spoken to learn that language. Because I was interested in doing that, but also out of, you know, necessity. And, and then writing in English, in a country where English isn't the official language, was also very frustrating for me because it locked me out of the writing community. You know, so I couldn't join book clubs of people who read in Dutch. I couldn't join writing clubs where people wrote in Dutch. And, but also I couldn't join, I didn't have access to the English writing community outside of Belgium. I remember going to England once for a writing workshop. I mean, I booked a ticket, got on the train and went to London.
Yes.
With 3-hour writing workshop because I wanted to be with a community of writers. And that also wasn't sustainable, having to go to London or wherever every time I wanted to meet with writers who wrote in English.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw an advert for a competition for short stories in Dutch, mm-hmm. I decided to to do it. I mean, I had nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did the competition. I sent in my short story and. To my biggest shock, it won.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really amazing. How long did it take you to learn Dutch, to be able to write it, you know?
I think my first year in Belgium, I took intensive courses, which is what you take if you want to go to college
mm-hmm.
in Belgium. If you've come from a different language and you want to get your first degree, mm-hmm. which is offered in Dutch, then you have to take an intensive language course. So I did an intensive language course for the basics. And then, I just sort of took courses here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I can say that I've learned, you sort of never learn enough to, let me rephrase it.
Mm.
I didn't write in Dutch because I thought I had learned enough to write in Dutch. I wrote in Dutch because I wanted to find opportunities. I wanted to break into that world. Mm. And I knew that it would take me a lot of courage to do so. And so I think it was more daringness than thinking that I had mastered the language, because I still haven't. I mean, there are some nuances that still escape me.
Yes.
But the good thing about it is that when you're writing in a language that is not your first language,
mm-hmm.
I think your writing style is different as well, and it's maybe more. I mean, I've had people tell me that they found it very interesting. Because of its difference, I don't want to use the word exotic, but because of the way it's so different from the way that they would use the language. So, you know, you're seeing all these things that they take for granted, things that they don't see.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And, you know, speaking about how a language sounds different depending on how you use it, this leads me to my next question, which, is about, the fact that, many of your stories, for example, on Black Sister Street, has mm-hmm. this very vibrant and powerful, you know, English. It has a pop to it, you know, particularly in the scenes that take place in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
The spaces and relationships are conceived in as these live, moving things.
Mm-hmm.
But one gets a sense of this sort of dumbing down in Antwerp. And mm-hmm. I wondered if, you know, this sort of contrasting energy between Nigeria and Belgium that manifests itself in the language, if it was a deliberate choice on your part.
No, it's fascinating for me to hear this. But I think there's a different sort of, I feel the same between Lagos and Abuja, I think. Mm. I always say that Lagos has a certain soul to it. I mean, you come into Lagos and you see the world differently, even you hear language differently as well. And then you go to Abuja. Abuja is clean and antiseptic. You know, Abuja doesn't excite me the same way that, for example, Lagos does.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't something I did deliberately. Maybe, you know, just something that wrote itself into the book. Yes.
Because there's some memorable lines. I mean, Sissy, when she arrives in Antwerp, she,
mm-hmm.
I think she transfers emotions to things. So she calls the room a sardonic room. I walked into a sardonic room and she, mm-hmm. but she still has these lively similes. She compares buttocks to old clay pots, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And she says hunger rumbles in a stomach like an old goods train. It's mm-hmm. chugging in a stomach. And, there's splashes of Nigerian pigeon in the dialogue. And I wondered if some of these similes and metaphors are they direct translation from like other languages in Nigeria, or is it just the type of English in Nigeria,
There was something a friend told me yesterday. We were talking. He's Nigerian. He's Yoruba. And I tried to give him a Dutch book to read because he speaks Dutch well. You know, he can read Dutch. And he said, no, I never read in Dutch. And I said, well, why? And he said, because when I'm thinking in Yoruba. And when I speak English, I'm going from Yoruba. And if I have to read a Dutch book, it would have to be from, I'm reading that Dutch and then translating it to English and then translating it to Yoruba so that it can make sense to me. And I was like, oh, wow, that is so interesting. And I think that sometimes when I write, some of the similes and metaphors in some of the language is a direct transliteration of Igbo. From Igbo to English. And yeah, now that you say it, and I think that's one of the things that some of my Belgian readers say too, that some of the ways I write Dutch, or even some of the choice of words or choice of comparisons I make, that they find it very interesting because it's not something that they would hear or read in a Dutch book, because I'm working from a different, I'm translating or translating well, context.
That's amazing. What you said about your Nigerian friend. And I think it leads to the question. I wanted to know, do you conceptualize in Dutch when you're writing in Dutch? And does that change, for example, the Nigeria that comes out on the page? Is the Nigeria that you think about in Dutch the same as the Nigeria that you'd conceptualize in English, for example?
Oh, wow. I've never thought of this. I probably conceptualize of the same Nigeria, but maybe the way I would put it down on paper, put that Nigeria down on paper, would be different. And because, I mean, when I'm writing in English, I tend to write long, rambling, dense sentences, when I'm writing in Dutch, because Dutch is my third language and I came to Dutch as a grown up. The way I write, my written Dutch is a lot simpler. It's not simplistic. It's just a lot simpler.
Yes.
And my sentences are shorter, and more clipped. Because I haven't got the skills to write long, complicated, rambling, you know, dense sentences.
In Dutch,
yes. Yeah. And so it's a different style, and I like that style.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that style works for me in Dutch, and I don't know if it's a style that I could use in English and it would have the same effect. But it's just nice to be able to work in two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being the same person, but just being, it's like being two different kinds of writers. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's really fascinating. And you said that Dutch is your third language.
Mm-hmm.
What languages did you grow up speaking?
Igbo and English.
Igbo and English.
Yes.
So in
Nigeria, I mean, because of colonization, and as in many other colonized countries, so you learn your mother tongue and your stepmother tongue at the same time, right?
Yes, that's exactly.
You speak one at home and you use the other one at school.
Same thing back in Zimbabwe as well.
Yeah.
Is there like local literature in Igbo, for example, like children's stories or?
Oh my God, no. Well, I know that when I was young, so when my older siblings were in high school, they had to read an Igbo book by this guy called Tony Ubesie.
Mm-hmm. Like a whole novel.
It's a whole novel. Yeah, he had like two or three novels. But I don't think his books are still in print. And he died really, really poor. You know, he died in penury. And by the time I went to high school in Abuja, we didn't read it. We had to do the three Nigerian languages, but we had to have a very rudimentary knowledge of the three major Nigerian languages. Sorry, not three.
Mm-hmm.
not the three languages, because Nigeria has over 300 languages, but the three major ones, Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba, we had to learn to count 1 to 10 in each of them, which isn't really enough to do anything. I mean, our French, we had more in-depth French, because in Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba, we had to learn to count 1 to 10. We had to learn to say the alphabet. And we didn't even have written exams in them. We had oral exams where they would ask you to dance or to sing or to clap or to whatever, just to see if you understood, the phrase. So they asked us that maybe there would always be like a stack of maybe 10 different phrases. Mm-hmm. And the teachers would just pick out one of the phrases and ask you whatever, mm-hmm. Maybe dance or clap. And so what many people did, because some people didn't even bother learning the phrases. Mm-hmm. So they just learned the meaning of the 10. Mm-hmm. And they knew that there was a 1 in 10 chance that they'll get it right the first time. So I could say, clap your hands in Igbo and you start dancing, because, you know, but you also knew that if it was a good teacher, Chai would give you like 10 chances and definitely get it right. You know? But we had much more. We had it. I mean, by the time you left, by the time, you'd done your third year of French in secondary school, mm. You were supposed to know enough French to write an entire essay.
Whoa.
But nobody demanded the rest, demanded that of us in
the local languages.
Yeah. So, and then I remember that when I was very young, there was also, an Igbo newspaper,
mm-hmm.
but that also went out of circulation a long time ago.
Yeah.
And why is this so? I mean, for you to be able to write or read in Igbo,
yes,
you must be able to read and write English,
yes,
well. And Igbo literature would not, and there are many more people who read and write English,
yes,
in Igbo land, or Igbo people,
yes,
there are many more of them than those who read and write in Igbo language, mm-hmm. because Igbo isn't taught in all the schools, mm. even in the Igbo states, they're not taught in all the schools. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who speak Igbo fluently,
mm-hmm.
who can't read Igbo and who can't write Igbo. And mm-hmm. so, Igbo literature has very little market. Nobody is interested in investing that much money for very little returns.
That's fascinating. I think you've answered my next question, which was, I was going to ask you, if you think local languages have a space in literature. I know we have an oral tradition, but I guess in a country like Nigeria, where you say there are over 300 languages,
mm-hmm.
I guess, it's just trying to, you know, imagine how that would work.
Yeah. But Hausa literature is very vibrant. Oh. There are many Hausa writers who don't write in English, and they have a huge market that are being read in the north.
Oh, why is that so?
I think partly because Hausa is also one of the languages spoken outside of Nigeria.
Oh.
Hausa is spoken in many other parts of Africa. You can do Hausa literature universities in the UK and in the US. So there's a huge market for Hausa literature outside of Nigeria.
Oh.
And I think also that, the educational system in the north was so different in terms of, or is so different in terms of the way it's organized than the educational system in the southern part of Nigeria. And I think that in the north, Hausa literature and Hausa language is taught in schools,
oh.
unlike what happens in the southeast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no good school where you expected to learn Igbo language. And actually, the more elite the school, the better, again, in quotes,
mm-hmm.
the better the school, the less likelihood that you take any Igbo lesson at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are lots of, kids growing up in Enugu, which is basically the heartland of Igbo land, which is where I was born and raised,
mm.
who don't speak a word of Igbo.
Whoa.
You know, I went back to Nigeria I think it was 2 years ago, and I saw this 7-year-old girl who is, I mean, her parents are not even upper middle class.
Mm.
They're lower middle class, working class people, and she does not speak a word of Igbo because the school she goes to, which is a step higher than the public schools.
Yes.
They don't encourage any Igbo at all.
Whoa.
So this girl doesn't speak any Igbo and apparently doesn't understand any Igbo because she didn't understand me when I asked her. I mean, something as simple as what's your name. She didn't know what I was talking about. And in Igbo, yes. And then, but because her parents are not wealthy enough to send her to one of the private schools where they have teachers who actually teach proper English,
mm-hmm.
her English too is very, very, very flawed, you know.
Mm.
So she doesn't speak any Igbo.
And she doesn't speak.
Doesn't speak any English. So there's this whole generation of, you know, univocal, children who are not proficient in any language.
That is wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah, but it's also very sad because she came out to my father's house and she didn't know the difference between a cat and a rat.
Oh my goodness.
And she saw a cat. She was like, oh, this is a big rat. I'm like, it's not a rat, it's a cat.
It's a cat.
So, and she didn't know what the proper pronouns to use for, you know, for animals. Even when I asked her how old she was.
Mm.
And she couldn't even answer me in proper English, you know. Mm. And she went and said, oh, how old am I? Is 1 year old. How old am I? Is 2 years old. Until she got to 7.
Oh.
And I mean, I found it very annoying, but also very saddening.
Very sad.
You know, because she doesn't have the basis for good English. She's already lost that now. And due to her parents' financial status, so she's going to leave the school and move on maybe to another private secondary school where the teachers also don't speak very good English.
Mm.
And she still wouldn't be able to speak any. But the older she gets, the more difficult it's going to be for her to pick up Igbo.
Becomes a crisis.
Becomes a crisis. And so you have, I mean, I went to church.
Mm.
And this is a neighborhood where many people are working class.
Mm.
And honestly, I must have seen about, I don't know, 20 kids mm-hmm. running around in church. And not a single one of them, I'm not exaggerating, not a single one of them spoke Igbo. Not one.
Oh my goodness.
So it's...
So the parents are not teaching their children?
Parents are not teaching their children because they see Igbo as holding them back in terms of social mobility.
Oh my goodness.
But then they don't have the... And then all the people that they look up to, their bosses' children and or their bosses and the people they see on TV and etc. Everybody's speaking in English. And as far as they're concerned, the only way to give their children access to the center is by giving them the advantage of English. But then they don't have the funds to make sure that they're getting the right sort of access, you know.
Yeah, it's a catch 22 situation, and it's very, it's very saddening.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think like there'd be a space for, say, the Igbo language to be viable, say, in?
I mean, there definitely is. I don't think you can afford to have a language die out. And I mean, Igbo is, there are about, let me see, the Igbo speaking states in Nigeria
mm-hmm.
has over, maybe 3 million, if not more.
Oh, that's a substantial number.
It's a substantial number. Yeah. I'm going to have to find out the exact number because it's, I'm sure it's somewhere online.
Mm-hmm.
But Igbo is one of the endangered languages. Yes. You know.
Yeah.
That's... Officially. It's on the UNESCO list as an endangered language.
That's alarming. That's alarming.
It is alarming. And then you see, Dutch that has how many speakers and it is not endangered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a vibrant Dutch literature. There are people who speak it and they use it in schools. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why a language spoken by that number of people,
should die out.
But that is what is happening, you know. But one of the good things that's happened in the past few years is that I think last year they launched Magic TV Igbo.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, which is apparently very popular and So what literature isn't doing, the entertainment sector is doing. Yeah. That's good.
That's really great, Magic Igbo TV. Hopefully, you know, because when the language dies out, it's also a culture that dies out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, is it Rumi who said that language is the key to the soul or something?
Yes.
It's a window to a culture.
Yes.
And, one of the best ways of understanding a culture is by understanding the language, right?
Yes, exactly.
One of the examples I always use because I think it's so fascinating is the Igbo word ndo, right?
Ndo.
Ndo. And usually when ndo is translated into English, it is translated as sorry.
Sorry.
But ndo is not sorry, you know? So if I stub my toe, and if my mother-in-law stubs her toe,
mm-hmm.
I tell her sorry. She tells me, oh, but it's not your fault. Because sorry has a certain implication of
that you've wronged
culpability. Yes, it's you've done something wrong. But if my mother were to stub her toe and I tell her ndo, you know, she understands. Because ndo, what ndo has that sorry doesn't have is a certain level of empathy. Ndo says, you know, I feel for you and I feel with you, which is a very cultural concept. You know, it's a concept of we're all one. Mm. You know, whatever hurts you hurts me too, which is absent in the Western world.
It is.
That's why you can't understand why someone would tell you sorry for stubbing your own toe when it's not their fault.
And wow, so these are the nuances within a language and a culture.
Yes, definitely. And it's the same reason why in many African cultures we find it very difficult to understand that that's depression and that depression exists, or that depression is a mental health issue. I mean, in Igbo, for example, there are only maybe two or three words for mental health problems. And all those three words refer to the kind of mad person that runs around naked on the streets.
Yes.
You know, so the culture has the language has no word for the sort of mental health issues that for depression or for people feeling suicidal or for people, you know,
yes.
Or even for what's this one? The postpartum depression. There are no words for any of those things, you know.
Yes.
But then, if you look at the English language, there are I don't know how many culturally accepted and medical terms for all the spectrums of mental health challenges.
Yes.
There's the ADHD. There is this and there is that, and you know.
Yes.
But in many of our African languages, you don't have any of those. And that's the challenge that we're having, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like perhaps updating or modernizing our languages.
Modernizing, updating and opening, realizing that language grows and opening up spaces for all those words to come in. There's, on Facebook, we have the Igbo dictionary, project that I'm working on with, a whole lot of other people. And the idea of the project is to update the Igbo language with to update it with more contemporary words, but also socially relevant words. I mean, words like for example, barbecue. There's no word for barbecue in Igbo because that, you know, it wasn't something that was part of the culture.
Yeah.
When Igbo stopped, quote unquote, so we had to find words for that. And then we had to find words for postpartum depression and for all those other things that don't exist. Because if the words don't exist, it's very difficult for you to accept that thing exists even as a concept.
Yes. That's the bridge with language, language and culture. That's really exciting. An Igbo dictionary.
Mm-hmm. It's the Igbo dictionary. We've been working on it for years now, and you know, It's a challenge, but we're happy with it.
Wow, that's amazing. And hopefully other parts of the continent would take up such projects.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Kola Tubosu is doing something with the Yoruba language as well, and he's doing an amazing job.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow, wonderful. Chika, it has been so lovely talking to you. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And
thank you for having me.
Thanks.